I'm John Wiener. We'll be back next week talking about politics, thinking about the left, and living in the USA.
KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the relationship between art and politics. Now to headline news.
Sue Goodwin with these Pacifica headlines. On Sunday, the most important Hungarian election in years will commence as right-wing Prime Minister Viktor Orban faces his greatest challenge in years. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
Viktor Orban has managed to hold continuous power in Hungary for 16 years. During this time, he has entrenched his populist far-right ideology and centralized power in the office of the prime minister. But Orban's streak of success appears ready to end, as his party trails the opposition in several polls. Orban is faced by Peter Magyar, a former member of Orban's far-right party, who has left to lead the opposition. Unlike many previous Hungarian elections, many of the various opposition parties have stood down in this election to give Peter Magyar an advantage on election day. Orban faces criticism for a faltering economy and persistent corruption. Orban has also been one of the EU's greatest critics of Ukraine, and he has been very critical of the EU in general, clashing publicly with Zelensky and EU leaders. Orban claims that if he loses, the subsequent uncertainty will be devastating for Hungary. Earlier this week, Vice President J.D. Vance visited Hungary to give the embattled prime minister support. If Orban loses this weekend, it will be a major blow to the far right of Europe, among other things. From Pacifica News, I'm Noah Portner.
And in more news, the U.S. and Iran are set to begin negotiations tomorrow to end the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran. The talks face significant hurdles, including disagreement over control over the Strait of Hormuz, the future of Iran's nuclear program, and whether Israel's invasion of Lebanon is subject to the ceasefire. Today on social media, Iran's parliament speaker, Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, demanded a ceasefire in Lebanon and the release of blocked Iranian assets before any negotiations can begin. Boarding Air Force Two on his way to Pakistan, where the talks will take place, Vice President Vance, who will lead the talks for the U.S., said he will work with Iran if they act in good faith, but warned, quote, if they try to play us, quote, the U.S. won't be receptive. President Trump told the New York Post today that U.S. warships were being reloaded, quote, with the best ammunition to resume strikes on Iran if peace talks in Pakistan fail, close quote. And in more news, as Sudan's civil war approaches its third anniversary on April 15th, it remains one of the world's worst humanitarian and displacement crises. Speaking at a press conference in Geneva today, the World Health Organization's representative in Sudan warned of an escalation in the scale and frequency of attacks on healthcare in conflict-affected areas of Sudan. Shibli Sabani told reporters, quote, "In the 3 years of war, WHO has verified 217 attacks on healthcare with 2,052 deaths and 810 injuries," close quote. He added that attacks have become more frequent and deadly since 2025, with 16 attacks in the past 3 months alone, causing 194 deaths and 320 injuries. Sabani called on all parties to respect international humanitarian law and stressed that, quote, "without peace, there cannot be health," close quote. With these Pacifica headlines and for WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Radio. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. Today on Sojourner Truth, we talk what's happening now and what's next with the U.S. and Israel's war on Iran, Lebanon, and Yemen with Professors Gerald Horn and Yusuf Munayer and the historic U.N. resolution declaring the transatlantic trafficking of Africans and chattel slavery of Africans as the greatest crime against humanity in history with Professor Justin Hansford. You're listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. So it seems that the United States is not going to be blowing any ancient civilizations into the Stone Age with no hope of them ever resurrecting again. It also is unclear about whether this war is still moving or not for many of us. And if you're feeling like me, uncertain about the answer to the simple question, are we at war or not? You are not alone. I'm so glad to be joined by Professor Gerald Horn to help us to unpack some of the question. Dr. Horn is an activist, an attorney, and author of several books, over 36, and a frequent visitor guest here on Sojourner Truth. Might as well pull up and, yeah, as I say back home, and grab a hole, because you're about to be on the farm with us. You're here with us so much. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Horn.
Thank you for inviting me.
So let's start from the beginning, because it's unclear. We know that there is supposedly some talks that are supposed to be happening. Allegedly, there are not bombs that are dropping anymore, but you can help us think through that. And heard directly from Representative Raskin of the House of Representatives here in the United States that they expect the House to be back next week and to be talking about the authority for war. Help us to unpack, at least in the beginning, where are we right now with what is happening with this U.S. and Israel war on Iran?
Well, where we are right now is that talks supposedly will be unfolding in the Pakistani capital of Islamabad, presumably taking place as we speak. Strikingly enough, the terms of reference for these high-stakes negotiations or the 10-point plan put forward by Iran, which in the meantime has supplemented that initiative by suggesting that their frozen assets, principally held by the U.S. authorities, be unfrozen. And I think that that should tip you off to the reality that this has been a monumental defeat for U.S. imperialism. In fact, many sober analysts are suggesting that accidentally the result of this war has been to create a second level superpower, insofar as Iran will continue to control the Straits of Hormuz, therefore having a stranglehold on 20% of world's energy, particularly natural gas and petroleum, and as well the many states that are in the Gulf Cooperation Council that are across the strait from Iran and have been seen as U.S. allies, speaking of Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, Abu Dhabi, Qatar, etc., their prospects going forward are rather grim unless they come to an accommodation with Iran. And do not be surprised if within years, if not sooner, they become de facto protectorates of Iran, which will strengthen even more this idea that Iran has been not only the winner, but has catapulted itself into the front rank of nations. On this side of the Atlantic, we already have a glimpse of what's in store with the rise of the price of a gallon of gasoline at the pump, with the rise in the price of groceries, insofar as groceries are oftentimes transported by trucks that run on diesel fuel, with the rise in the price of jet fuel, which means an increase in airline fares, etc. This has also been a significant defeat for Mr. Trump, which has led to sniping between Trumpistas like Megyn Kelly and Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens, and Mr. Trump himself, who's responded in kind. But I think we also should connect the two stories of this late afternoon, early evening, because this setback to U.S. imperialism simultaneously should be seen as a step forward for the struggle for reparations to descendants of enslaved Africans. That is to say, if we are alert to what's going on in the world, if we are sufficiently agile to take our campaign to Cuba, to Ottawa, to Brussels, to Moscow, to Beijing, to South Africa, because Mr. Trump has managed to alienate so many different countries who will be looking, it seems to me, to strike back against U.S. imperialism. The question is, do our organizers and leaders have the gumption and audacity to take that bold move?
A lot unpacked there. I'm going to take some of it piece by piece. Thank you so much, Dr. Horn. I do want to talk before getting back to sort of impacts or the categories of gains, losses, both with respect to Iran and, of course, people that are in the region who have, you know, gained some in terms of, as you described, and obviously lost a lot as well, including human beings, and then also what's happened here in the States. But before going back to that, I'd love to talk about the impact on Africa, because we've heard so much about how this has impacted Europe. We've heard how this has impacted Asia, you know, various countries in Asia, and they've gone to a 4-day work week and, you know, concerns around oil there. We've heard about, of course, how it's impacted the United States to some degree, but really not a lot of conversation about the impact on Africa. And you know, you did bring up the resolution and the push for reparations and how that can connect. But aside from that, what has been the impact of this war on Africa? And I'm thinking about the bombing of Eastern Nigeria that happened at the end of last year. I'm thinking about, you know, the threats on Somalia, and just thinking about how that connects with what is happening here with the war on Iran.
Well, it's a mixed bag. On the one hand, you have African energy producers who will tend to benefit from the slowdown of energy coming out of the Straits of Hormuz. I'm looking at Algeria, a major natural gas producer, and you've already seen the neo-fascist prime minister of Italy, Giorgia Madame Meloni, to travel to Algiers to try to broker a new arrangement with this North African country. You have petroleum-producing countries like Angola and Nigeria and Gabon, which will tend to benefit as well from this war. But at the same time, we should not ignore the fact that if we reach this stratospheric level of $200 a barrel for petroleum, this will not only crush the U.S. economy, imagine what it will do to the economies in Africa. In fact, I got a text just the other day from Ghana talking about the knock-on effects, the negative knock-on effects in Ghana with regard to transport costs. With regard to other parts of Africa, keep in mind that the United Arab Emirates has played a devilish role in terms of the civil war in Sudan. Presumably because of having to stick to their domestic knitting, let us hope that they will pull out of the interference in Sudan's internal affairs, which has led to credible charges of genocide being leveled at the UAE. With regard to Somalia, there hangs a tale, because recall that the breakaway province of Somaliland from the larger Somalia has been recognized diplomatically by Israel because it has a strategic location across the Red Sea from Yemen, where Ansar Allah, otherwise known as the Houthis, have been launching missiles into Israel, helping to shut down temporarily, and perhaps even permanently to a degree, the Israeli port of Eilat. This is also strategically important for Israel because many Israeli leaders have suggested that in a best case scenario, from their point of view, after they dispense with Iran, they were going to turn on Turkey or Turkey. And it's that plays a major role in the larger Somalia, the Mogadishu-based Somalia, completing tasks, including educating Somali students, picking up the garbage, airport security, offshore oil drilling, a spaceport, etc. And so Israel would like to focus and basically fight out its war with Turkey on African soil. So the sum and substance is that the impact on Africa has been a mixed bag.
A mixed bag indeed, but still something that we definitely need to keep our eye on. And thank you so much for sharing that, because again, we don't hear much about the impact of this U.S. and Israel war on Iran, Lebanon, and Yemen, as well as other countries once we start getting into it. And so really, thank you so much for sharing that. You're listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, me, Nana Jumfe, and we are speaking with historian, attorney, author, and political analyst, Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn, when we, you know, you talked about this shifting of power, and not sure how much of it is live and how much of it is Memorex. And I'm definitely dating myself with that reference, but I'm not sure how much is live and how much is Memorex. But it does seem as if this, what has happened with Iran, the moves that Iran has made, has exposed some of the multipolar expression that we have now in terms of political power on a global level. And something that people maybe at one time were frightened of in terms of there not being sort of this clear line between the good guys and the bad guys in folks' minds. And of course, good and bad is going to be determined by, you know, whose side you're rooting for. But this now kind of a multipolarity about what power looks like and where power comes from. Talk a little bit more about that, please.
Well, it's apparent that Russia is a major victor of this war against Iran, not least because it's raised the price of a barrel of petroleum, which Russia has in profusion. Speaking of petroleum, it was not so long ago that India was being pressured by the United States to stop buying Russian petroleum. Now India has to buy Russian petroleum at a premium. Keep in mind as well that China is likely a major victor as well, because The Economist, the conservative British weekly, its current cover story has a picture of President Xi Jinping and Mr. Trump, with the headline being, don't interrupt your antagonists when they're in the process of making a mistake. In other words, in terms of the high stakes war, in quotes, between China and the United States has weakened itself by waging war against Iran. And I might also say parenthetically that this war against Iran, to a degree, has weakened the counter-revolution that was in motion since November 2024, January 2025. That is to say that many of us have thought that with the kidnapping and abduction of the Venezuelan president, that counter-revolution had gotten a shot in the arm, but that was a premature conclusion. And I think that what we should draw from this, that is to say domestic strugglers and battlers should draw, is how intimately connected our struggle here in North America is to global events, something that is oftentimes lost sight of, sadly and tragically enough. That is to say that with the squabbling on the right between the podcasters like Carlson and Candace Owens, Megyn Kelly, et cetera, there's obviously a fracture in the right wing. It's difficult for any movement to go forward when it's fractured internally. And that gives us on this side of the Atlantic in North America a kind of breathing space. But unless we take advantage of this advantage that we now hold, we'll find ourselves in months again behind the eight ball. That's why it's so important for our leaders and our organizations to pay more careful attention than they have to this point to global affairs, international affairs, and of course, sending delegations across the ocean, across the seas, in order to build bridges to allies and comrades.
Thinking about the movements of people on the ground, as a person who has been engaged in organizing for over three decades, and including, of course, because the United States is never not at war, work in the area of peace, right, in the peace movement, and thinking about how we get people, more people even in the streets, right? And so we have, for example, No Kings, where we have millions of people that come out, and there's a variety of issues that people are raising. And of course, the anti-war conversation has been part of those No King spaces, but there really hasn't been like the outpouring. When I think about the wars on Iraq and the ways in which people really filled the streets, even thinking about the genocide in Palestine and the way that people have filled the streets that, you know, there, and thinking about these like ultimatums given by Mr. Trump around, you know, going to bomb all the bridges and, you know, commit war crimes and bombing ancient civilizations so they'll never come again, and expecting maybe more folks out. And I was one that ran out to see, hey, where can we get into some good trouble, but not seeing as much as I think I've seen in the past. What do you make of that? And, you know, what kinds of things should we be doing to get that kind of pressure around the war in particular?
Well, that's the $64 question, is it not? And I would make this analysis that it is more than a notion to organize a mass anti-war, indeed anti-imperialist movement. But I think that the least we can do on this side of the Atlantic is develop an analysis of how we got to this point, which has had such terrible ramifications and repercussions worldwide. Because that analysis can then be exported to our friends and allies in Cuba, in Iran, and elsewhere, so that they can better steel themselves against U.S. imperialism's onslaught. I was thinking of this in particular with regard to Mr. Trump's genocidal social media posts aimed at Iran just the other day. And there were so many commentators, particularly, I'm afraid to say, many liberal commentators, who were suggesting that this was so out of the ordinary in terms of how the United States has conducted itself. And as a historian who's written at length about settler colonialism and the process whereby this nation came into being, recognizing that there was genocide committed, for example, in Texas, the topic of one of my more recent books, whereby indigenous groupings by the scores were wiped out, liquidated. And if you understand that history, then you'll be able to understand why Mr. Trump is able to make similar kinds of genocidal statements in 2026. And therein lies what we can help to contribute to the worldwide movement, a better analysis of this monster headquartered in Washington, how it came to be. And then is as we develop that sort of analysis, perhaps we'll then tweak some of our movements. I mean, for example, the No Kings movement, which was touted as a global movement, but when it manifested in London, since they have a king as a head of state, albeit with his wings clipped, it was called No Tyrants, a ditto across the border in Canada. No Tyrants, not No Kings. And I think that the No Kings organizers, and bless their souls, I congratulate them on their successes, I think that they haven't kept up to speed with this historiography. There's a gathering and growing critique of the overthrow of monarchy in North America, what it led to, a critique of the so-called small R republicanism, which led to a decline of the divine right of kings and the rise of the divine right of propertied men of European descent who happened to be settlers. So once again, until we come to some sort of understanding on basic fundamental points of history, it'll be difficult to organize the mass movement, but at least we can organize an analysis that comports with reality.
Thank you so much, Dr. Horn, for helping us to organize an analysis that comports with reality. Really appreciate you coming on. Have a wonderful rest of your evening. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
That was professor, historian, attorney, author, political analyst, Dr. Gerald Horn. We will do some more unpacking of the U.S. war against Iran, Lebanon, and Yemen with Professor Youssef Manyar after this station break. So much pressure, so much pressure. Jill Scott helping us to have some music in the back as we are thinking about how to move in the front. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. We continue our discussion of the U.S. and Israel war on Iran, pulling in now Lebanon and Yemen with Professor Youssef Manyar. Youssef Manyar is a Palestinian-American writer, political analyst, and policy advocate specializing in U.S. policy towards Israel and Palestine. Thank you so very much for joining us.
It's very nice to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, when we thought it was bad enough, as this war started and it was focused on Iran, and then we begin to see the attacks on Lebanon, the attacks on Yemen. And again, I think for many of us, it seems confusing. I mean, if the purpose of going into Iran, according to Mr. Trump, and I'm calling him that because I'm just borrowing from Professor Horn here, because I usually call him some other stuff and not allowed to curse on TV, on the radio. if the purpose is to go in and to, you know, stop a nuclear program, all of these things that he described specific to Iran, then what is going into Lebanon and Yemen doing? Help us to understand what are the pretexts, what is real, and what is happening.
Right. Well, first, let me just say, I think Professor Horn did a wonderful job of laying so much of this out. I think, you know, first of all, this is a regional war, and it has been a regional war for some time. This is, it's important to remember, an extension of the genocidal war on Gaza that's been going on for a few years now. And of course, as that genocidal war on Gaza began in the fall of 2023, so many of us were warning that the continuation of that war would not remain limited to Israel and Gaza, but it would ultimately become a regional conflagration. And of course, here we are. This is a process that has been building for some time. But I think it's important for listeners to understand when you ask about Lebanon and Yemen, for example, and let's also not forget Iraq and other countries as well that have been drawn into this in one way or another, that there is a constellation of alliances throughout the region, which oftentimes work together. And from the Iranian perspective, I think it's important for us to keep in mind here, you know, there is a long history of animosity between Iran and the United States. In 1953, of course, the United States and the British decided that they knew what was better for Iran than Iranians, and they organized a coup in Iran to depose the elected prime minister of Iran at the time, because he wanted to nationalize Iran's oil resources. And they installed instead a Western-friendly dictator, the Shah of Iran, who many Iranians over time came to absolutely despise, and by extension despise the West and the United States in particular as well. This, of course, brings us to the Islamic Revolution, and we know much of the history of animosity between Iran and the United States after that. But particularly after September 11th in 2001, from the Iranian perspective, okay, the United States, which has bases all over the region and surrounding Iran, invades Afghanistan, which is Iran's neighbor to the east. And then they put Iran on a list, an axis of evil list, along with Iraq and North Korea. And then they invade Iraq, Iran's neighbor to the west. And so if you're sitting in Tehran, you are thinking very carefully about the reality that, number one, not only are you surrounded by bases, but you're next up. You're next up on the list. And so part of Iran's broader defense and deterrence strategy in the region to hold the U.S. at bay was to create alliances and proxies in different countries and support them. And now these proxies, groups like Hezbollah and the Houthis in Yemen and different groups in Iraq as well, they have their own local domestic dynamics, but they are in alliances with Iran as well. And through these alliances, Iran hopes to put something of a check on Israel, which they see as the extension of U.S. power in the region. And in so doing, kind of keeping that American invasion of Iran at a distance for as much as possible. All that is to say that, you know, this has been a long time in the making. Yes, it's happening now, but this has been a long time in the making. I think the Iranians have expected that this day would eventually come and have also been planning for it for a very, very long time, which is one of the reasons why this war of aggression on Iran did not necessarily go the way that President Trump and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel initially thought that it would go.
I want to talk about Lebanon in a minute, because I feel like anytime the United States or Israel decides that they want to do something, they want to attack a country or attack a people in the region, Lebanon gets pulled in. And I want to talk about that. Before we talk about that, would you, is this part of the plan? Like, I'm trying to understand, what is the U.S.'s plan? Because I know that there is, you know, people like to think like there's just no plan and it's just like the actions of a madman. And I'm not saying that that may not be partially true, but there is some plan. What do you think that the plan was? Like, what is this all for, given how much the U.S. also had to lose and lost?
Well, it's a great question. And it's not just because the president of the United States himself has been extremely incoherent in the things that he said just in the last, you know, 6 weeks or so about this situation, but also because of the United States' policy that really predates Donald Trump. Look, the United States has a couple core interests in the region, and the single most important one is to ensure that there is a free flow of natural resources into the global market and that no single power, either in the region or outside of the region, is able to monopolize or dominate those natural resources, and in so doing, prevent others from accessing them. That's the sort of key overarching American strategic interest in the region. But there is also, importantly, the U.S. alliance with Israel. And Israel is a co-belligerent in this war on Iran. And over time, I think what has become clear is that there are, you know, almost two different sets of American foreign policy in the region. One that is driven by a sort of realist perspective on international relations and what should be happening in the region in terms of American interests. And then another foreign policy that is primarily shaped by Israeli interests. And I think that's what we are seeing more of today than ever before, is that the United States is acting in a way that is not in the interests of the United States, but is instead in the perceived interest of the Israeli government and its Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in particular. Israel seeks a degree of hegemony throughout the region and wants to establish that by destroying any opposition to its hegemony among any other actors in the region, whether that's in Lebanon or in Syria or in Iraq, and now in Iran, and of course among the Palestinians as well. And so I think the Israeli vision for what they'd like to see for Iran might be different than what the American national interest is in the region. And these things have become so conflated in this partnership between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu in these last several weeks that the United States is realizing now that this is not good. This doesn't make sense for us. Even if it might make sense for Benjamin Netanyahu, it's not good for America. It's not good for the American people. And I think, you know, every person who stops by the gas pump and has for the last several weeks is coming to that same conclusion.
So I just have a few more questions. Thank you so much for helping with that, because I think that helps make clear like why we see these different things happening that seem to be incongruent, but it's like two different agendas trying to figure out how to work with one another or not. Let's talk about Lebanon, because Lebanon is a country that has always had just been the punching bag, as far as I can see, whenever there's conflict in that area. I mean, I'm a person from Ghana, and I know, you know, lived on the continent for a while, and there are people from Lebanon that are all throughout the continent, all throughout the Caribbean, and I'm sure other parts of the world that have been displaced because of war there. And then we see that whether it was the, you know, the beginning of the next wave of genocide in Palestine, or this war here on Iran and other countries in the region, that Lebanon again gets hit. What is it about Lebanon?
Well, first, Lebanon is a beautiful country, and its people are absolutely wonderful, and they have suffered a tremendous amount over many years. Look, Lebanon is a small country. It's even smaller than Israel. It does not really have a very powerful army. The Lebanese state is quite reliant on the United States, so it often has to step aside whenever there is a conflict with Israel. And that leaves the defense of Lebanon not to the Lebanese state and the Lebanese military, but to organized militias, in this case, Hezbollah, which is dominant in the southern part of Lebanon and, of course, routinely clashing with Israel to push back against Israeli attacks. And of course, Israel had for many years occupied a significant chunk of Lebanon, something that they're seeking to do again now, until they were pushed out after 18 years by Hezbollah in the year 2000. And of course, Lebanon has also been the place where refugees from Palestine poured in after the ethnic cleansing of 1948, where refugees from Syria poured in during the years of the Syrian civil war. And so Lebanon has seen a lot in terms of conflict and in terms of war and different challenges that have really been thrown upon it by the region, and particularly by Israel. And despite this, you know, I think the Lebanese people have a tremendous will to continue to strive and move forward and really build a beautiful future for themselves. But they're struggling to do so under this constant bombardment. And, you know, the Israelis do not respect Lebanese sovereignty. And have violated the ceasefire with Lebanon thousands of times in the last many months prior to this most recent war on Lebanon after the war on Iran began. This is one of the key challenges that Lebanon faces. And in the last several days, we've just seen absolutely horrific bombing by the Israelis across Lebanon, and particularly in parts of Beirut, which left hundreds of people, of course, civilians, primarily killed as a result of these really heinous attacks on civilian infrastructure by the Israeli military.
Thank you so, so very much, Professor, for coming on with us. We really appreciate it. We certainly will have you back. There's so much more to unpack. Hopefully it will be at a time of at least some level of peace. We appreciate you. Have a wonderful rest of your evening.
Thanks so much. Same to you all.
That was Professor Youssef Mounouyer, and he was speaking with us about the U.S. and Israel war on Iran, Lebanon, and Yemen. We now move to the topic of the UN resolution that is calling the transatlantic slave trade, as some refer to it, and the chattel slavery of African people as a crime, the greatest crime against humanity in history. So glad to be speaking now with Professor Justin Hansford. Professor Justin Hansford is an attorney and a professor at law at Howard University. He also has been on the United Nations Permanent Forum for the People of African Descent, which is how I know him. And the PIFPAD comes on again next week. Greetings, Justin.
Greetings. Thank you for inviting me on, Nana. Glad to be here.
So this resolution, I think that there's some confusion, which I'm hoping you can clear up. This is a lot of confusion getting cleared up on the show today. People are talking about it as reparations. Reparations are on nine. And this is related, but not quite reparations. Help folks understand what this resolution is, what it says, and just a little bit of how we even got here.
Oh, sure. Well, it's part of this campaign to take reparations from a political demand to a legal obligation. And it is, as you said, it's a resolution, so it's not a legal obligation yet. So we are moving in that direction. And it's been part of a long journey. I'm sure your listeners know that the call for reparations has been happening since enslavement began. We can go back to Belinda Sutton in the 1700s, who was a Black woman in Massachusetts who filed a petition for repair for her capture from West Africa and enslavement. And she even received some recompense from that back in the 1700s. And then, of course, we can go to 1800s and everyone from, the pensioners, the formerly enslaved pensioners fund that was brought about to fight against, the things that were happening right after enslavement and all the way through Queen Mother Moore in the 20th century. And of course, James Forman and Cobra. So there's a long history of reparations that in the United States that we can speak to. But what's happening right now is a global movement that is including all sorts of discussion around repair for enslavement and colonialism, whether that means talking about the return of stolen art and cultural artifacts, whether it means the process of truth-telling, whether that means the process of apologies from colonial entities, the creation of commissions to see if there is going to be some sort of repair, whether that is financial in a form of debt relief when it comes to countries in the Caribbean, South America, on the continent. Of course, many people, I'm saying all this because many people, when they hear the word reparations, they think about a check. They think about it going to individual people for slavery. But this discussion has grown and it's become much larger. I mean, in this resolution, you see the discussion around the particular treatment of enslaved African women who, you know, after the Virginia statutes, which said that slavery was something that descended through the mother's womb, became a process of using African women's reproductive capacity as a mechanism for capital accumulation and dehumanizing them. And that's something that is part of what needs to be repaired and what needs to be fixed as well. It's not just about labor that was stolen, right? It's about people's humanity, of course. And we can go on and on to talk about the way that slavery did not accompany capitalism's growth on the world stage. It helped to constitute it. And you can go to Cedric Robinson and Black Marxism to learn about that history. But that this is when the resolution says slavery was the greatest crime against humanity, I hope people don't fall into the narrative of thinking it's some type of hierarchical statement that ranks people's pain. To my understanding, it's a statement that speaks about the global centuries-long impact on the entire world that this system implemented that really changed the world and helped to frame the world and create the world that we live in right now. And so many of the things that we're talking about earlier on this call were about that legacy. So there's a lot of things to talk about, a lot of things to think about. The resolution is a great read for those who haven't been able to Google it and check it out. I suggest you do so directly and learn more about what's happening.
Absolutely. And our world, the world that folks are living in right now, there's no aspect of it that is untouched by what has happened and now called in a UN resolution the greatest crime against humanity in history. And again, not in a hierarchical way, but in a way that describes its magnitude. You're listening to Sojourner Truth, and we are speaking with Justin Horsford, who is a professor of law at Howard University School of Law and the founder and executive director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center. Want to talk about the countries that decided that they were going to vote for it, the countries that abstained and the countries that opposed. So think about 123 countries voted for it. Europe abstained. And then there were three countries I'll let you name that opposed the resolution. And talk about what you make of that.
Yes, Israel, the United States, and Argentina opposed the resolution. I think that the one that may surprise some listeners who may not be familiar with Argentina's racial history, also a country that had enslavement at one time, many of its largest cities were half people of African descent. But after a government process of self-declared whitening of the race, now that country is under 1% people of African descent. Also a country that has been accused of providing space for Nazis to escape detection there. So I think that vote is a roll call, if you will. It's like an attendance sheet. It's a statement of political, moral, and ethical reality for the world. And now it's not surprising that we saw the things play out the way they did. Not only did you have these votes, but then the votes were also backed up by statements. The U.S. came out and said that they felt like slavery was legal at the time that it was done, and so that would justify their no vote. Of course, we know that there's a lot of reasons why that is a false statement. We had an African, West African attorney who, back even in the 1600s, went to the Vatican, which, as we know, the Vatican is the place where slavery was inaugurated in the 1400s in the Dum de Versus citation from 1452. And this attorney, who was able to argue very effectively that this policy of slavery was, according to him in 1684, his name was Lorenzo de Silva Mendoza, and he talked about divine law, natural law, and civil law, and successfully argued that slavery was actually in violation of the Vatican's own law back in 1684. So they knew that it was in violation of their own legal standards back then. And of course, you look at other scholars, Jenny Martinez, who wrote a book called The International Human Rights and the Slave Trade, speaks about how even in the 1800s, there were courts that were set up understanding that the slave trade should be in violation of what was becoming international law back then. And so there have been a number of laws that were broken in the process of enslavement. Even if you were to take that historical lens as your starting point. So that's part of this understanding that we need to know that international law, international human rights law, is not something that can only be written by those who are committing the offenses, right? So what did African scholars think about what was international law back then? What did other people around the world think about what was just or moral back then? And why isn't that taken as part of our understanding of what justice looks like? I mean, so that was what this is a project that I know a lot of people are trying to understand the impact of what happened. I believe that impact was historic in part because it caused us to open the door to all of the discussion and the back and forth and the reasoning around this issue, so that the entire world can actually look at the substance of the argument. And right now, 123 nations, the overwhelming majority of the nations in the world, do believe that people of African descent deserve reparations. That itself is a statement that ought to take this discourse way out of the margins, where people have been for years trying to frame reparations as a fantastical, a complete, radical vision that was very far from being achieved. But the reality is most of the world knows that this is what justice is about. And so eventually we're going to just have to find our political will.
Absolutely. We only have a couple minutes left, Professor Hansford.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about the PIFPAD, mm-hmm. the UN Permanent Forum for People of African Descent. You are one of the founding members appointed by the State Department of the United States to be there and you know, have always been one that was clear and brilliant as you stored us through those 3-4 days of people of African descent coming from all over the world to grapple with all of the issues that we're dealing with, right? In terms of civil society and engaging with member states, et cetera. I'm thinking about this resolution and as we go into the PIFPAD next week, how impactful do you think that will be? I want to say as a side note that with BAJI, Black Alliance for Just Immigration, we talk about migration for Black people being something that should be on the table for reparations. You see that Great Britain, you have some people there that are saying all the countries that voted for the resolution that are their, you know, Black countries, countries of the South, should be banned from immigrating to Great Britain. So there's some mumblings about that. But what do we have to take into the PIFPAD in the last minute or so that we have here together?
Well, it's going to be a wonderful gathering, April 14th through 17th. We're going to talk about 25 years after the Durban Declaration and Program of Action, that wonderful Durban Conference in 2001 that really brought us closer to this resolution moment. And we're going to talk about 5 years of the Permanent Forum on People of African Descent. This is our 5th year anniversary, so we're going to have some reflection. We're going to have a special day dedicated for the work of youth, to focus on the youth agenda for youth of African descent throughout the diaspora. And we're also going to focus on reparations for one entire day, speaking a lot about the returning of stolen artifacts, but of course the resolution will be front and center. So we know that for me, when we think about what the PIFPAD represents, it's this Pan-African space where Black people from every corner of the diaspora have a voice and they have a chance to come together and think about their common agenda points and explore policy solutions and really just explore exchanging ideas on how to get justice and freedom for our people. And it seems clear that reparations has been the framework that has emerged as the one that is the most unifying. I always tell people that reparations is what justice will look like in the 21st century, not just for our people, but really for throughout the world. And we see wars and sanctions and all these tools you see that we describe for the rest of this call just failing to produce just results, in part because you're not actually providing remedy or healing for anyone with these tools. You're just trying to force other nations' hand to do your bidding. But what this is just not a moment for our people, as important as that is, over a billion of our people of African descent around the world who deserve justice. But this is a moment for the world to turn the corner and to start thinking about what it means to create justice and global justice in a new millennium. So it's an important moment, not just for a billion people of African descent. And of course, that's not a small thing for a billion people, but it's an important moment for the entire planet. It's really a beautiful thing to witness.
Thank you so very much. Absolutely. When Black people are free, everyone will be free. Thank you so much, Justin. Really appreciate you being on. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
That was Professor Justin Hansford on the UN resolution and the UN Permanent Forum for People of African Descent. And that is our show. I'd like to thank our guests. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, including our dear sister, Margaret Prescott, our board operator, Aziz Fomenko, and producer, Gary Scott, and you for joining us. Let's get together at the same time and same place next week for Sojourner Truth Radio. Be well. Thank you.
você já foi à Bahia?